Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the backlash to efforts by former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and Gloria Steinem to urge women, and young women in particular, to vote for Hillary Clinton. We'll look into the apparent split between younger and older feminists following the votes in the Iowa caucus, where younger women aged 18 to 29 voted for Bernie Sanders over Hillary Clinton by a margin of 6-1. Joining us first is Amanita Fanaro, a student in New York City and a first-time voter in the 2016 presidential race, who was a passionate supporter of Bernie Sanders. We will discuss why young millennial women prefer the 74-year-old senator from Vermont to the former Secretary of State and First Lady, who, if elected, would be the first female president of the United States. Then we'll get another opinion on which of the two Democratic presidential candidates is winning the feminist vote, and speak with Gloria Felt, the co-founder and president of Take the Lead and author of No Excuses, 9 Ways Women Can Change How We Think About Power. The former president of Planned Parenthood, she joins us to discuss why younger voters find Bernie Sanders more authentic than Hillary Clinton and what Clinton can do to keep millennials in the tent and motivated to vote in the event Bernie loses the nomination to her. Then finally, we will speak with Emil Hokayam, a senior fellow at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London, who has an article at Foreign Policy, Obama's Disastrous Betrayal of the Syrian Rebels, How the White House is Handing Victory to Bashar al-Assad, Russia, and Iran. We will discuss the gains Russia and Iran are making on the ground in Syria and whether or not Saudi Arabia and Turkey will try to counter Putin without the backing of the United States. And joining us now is Amanita Fanaro, who's a student in New York City and a first-time voter in the 2016 presidential race. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amanita Fanaro.
Hello, I'm Amanita.
Well, I'm glad you can join us, and I'm very interested in getting your perspective because, as you know, there's a bit of a dispute going on following remarks by former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright in campaigning with Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire, and remarks on the Bill Maher HBO program where Gloria Steinem suggested that some of the young women voting for Bernie Sanders may be doing so because they're influenced by their boyfriends. She walked back those remarks, but nevertheless, there appears to be a division of opinion amongst young and older feminists. So since you're a first-time voter, you'll be turning 18 in June, I believe. What's your perspective on this?
Well, it really upsets me because, like, it's the complete opposite of the whole point. The whole point is we're voting to vote for who is the best candidate regardless of gender. And now we're mixing up something that's supposed to clear our heads and get us to the right perspective. But instead, now we're mixing it up and saying we have to vote for her because she's a female. No, that's not the whole point of it. The whole point of it is to vote for who we think is right, not for based on gender. So now she's saying, I just looked into it, and Albright saying, oh, if you don't vote for Hillary, you're going to be in hell or something like that. Now we're putting religion into this. And then she basically makes women feel stupid for thinking that if they're voting for Bernie, they're not supporting women. They're not being a good woman. Why does voting for Bernie have anything to do with being a good woman? Hillary Clinton, okay, she's a woman. That's great. Okay, it's amazing that she is putting herself out there and we're finally possibly having a female president. But if she is not a good candidate as a person, then I don't think that's what we should be going for. If we're going to be voting for a woman as our first president, it should be the right candidate for that. So that's just my opinion. I don't think she really deserves that. And the way they're making it seem like, oh, boyfriends are influencing us, boyfriends are telling us what to do. No, then we're all back to the whole thing about how men are controlling us and men are telling us what to do. No, we are voting for who we want because that's who we want, not because someone is telling us to or we have to feel obligated to vote for another female.
So I guess that's a line that's being crossed that most people object to, right? Nobody wants to be told who to vote for.
No, of course not. No one wants to be told who to vote for because at the end of the day, it is your decision. But it's terrible that people want to influence people that intensively and really make them feel guilty for what they want, for what they believe in. That shouldn't be the issue. And then this comes across the whole issue again of feminism in general. Feminism gets confused all the time about how women are better than men. The whole point is we're equal. If we forget that whole weird middle part where we make it like, no, female are better, we're supposed to be equal. That's the whole point of it. And this just rises the whole issue again of female are better. We need to vote for her because she's female. No, we need to vote for who is right, who has the right words to say, who has the right opinions, who will make this country better. And that's just what we should be focusing on, not on the gender.
But, Amanita Fanaro, older feminists, of course, make the argument that we're the ones who actually have been chipping away at the glass ceiling. We're the ones that have made changes, and still there's obviously a long way to go because women still don't have equal pay for equal work. But that's their argument, and that younger feminists don't seem to appreciate, at least that's the charge, what their older feminists have achieved.
Well, older feminists have achieved a lot, and I'm not saying we shouldn't appreciate that and we shouldn't recognize that, because we do, and we should. And women still have a long way to go, but they still have come a long way, and they're getting there, and there's more and more. But I don't think deciding that voting for her isn't part of that, then that's not the right thing. I mean, we still have a long way to go, but that doesn't mean Bernie won't support that, Bernie won't fix that, Bernie won't help that. I feel like that's just getting confused again, and that's not the point we're trying to get at.
And again, I'm speaking with Amanita Fanaro, who's a student in New York City and a first-time voter in the 2016 presidential race. I suppose, though, just to be fair to Hillary Clinton, she didn't make those remarks, although she was certainly standing right next to Madeleine Albright when she made the remark that there's a special place in hell for women who don't support other women. I think it's pretty clear what she was getting at there. And she certainly wasn't on Bill Maher when Gloria Steinem made the remark that she's now walked back. So tell me about why you and your generation of millennials are supporting Bernie Sanders over Hillary Clinton.
Because he just has what we want. He says the things that we agree with. He knows what's going to help us better. And every time Hillary has said something, I've never really been with it. It makes me feel like she's not really going to change anything. She's not really going to do anything to benefit us. And I feel like Bernie knows what the younger people want. Bernie knows what's going to make us happy, and Bernie knows what's going to be. He wants a revolution, and they said like, oh, Hillary's going to be the revolution. Hillary becoming a female president is the revolution. No, that's not what I agree with. If Bernie can create a revolution that could change the future for everyone, especially my generation, then that's who we want. That's the other thing. Like I was discussing before was, the adults are forgetting about this whole generation that's going to take over by like a flow that no one is going to expect. We're going to take over and we're going to probably vote for Bernie, and no one's going to see that coming because everyone's only seeing the debates and the adults that are involved and what's going on with that. But no one's really seeing what's going on social media, what's going on with the teenagers that are discussing with themselves. Just because we're not as involved, I guess you could say, doesn't mean we won't be involved at the end result. And the generation is going to take by storm, and all the younger people are probably going to surprise you. And I feel like Bernie's just going to end up winning. That's just probably what's going to happen, because there's just so many teens and so many kids who are so involved that we don't realize that just want Bernie. I feel like that's just what's going to happen. If you saw a rally that happened not so long ago, there was like over 50,000 teens just there supporting him. And that's a crazy amount. And it's not just them. There's so much more that we just don't even realize.
So what happens, though, Amanita, if, you know, through this primary process, Bernie, he's certainly probably going to win tomorrow in New Hampshire, but eventually the pundits say that probably Hillary will end up being the nominee. Would you and your generation be disappointed that Bernie's no longer on the ticket and not vote? Would that, of course, would make it easier for one of these Republicans like Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, or Marco Rubio to get elected?
We would be probably extremely disappointed, because then it would probably just leave Republicans and the Democrat Party would be pushed out completely, I'm assuming. And that's going to be probably the most disappointing thing to feel, that America is going to be left with the Republican Party. And I've just never really, like, I agree with some things the Republican Party says, but at the end of the day, the Democrats the country will be safer and feel better. But we will be extremely disappointed. Like, I have to admit, we'll be really upset. There's probably going to be a lot of stuff being thrown out there through social media, and kids will be upset. No, they're not going to want to vote. They're going to probably not feel like doing it anymore.
But do you recognize that that's not a particularly useful strategy? I mean, would you demand a role for Bernie Sanders? In other words, Bernie Sanders has started a movement, it would seem to me, that if he doesn't make it to the presidency, why not continue the movement. And all of what he stands for in terms of equal opportunity and getting rid of the power of Wall Street and stopping the widening gap between the rich and the poor and, mm-hmm. and all of the things that have drawn you to Bernie Sanders, there's no reason why he can't continue that movement.
He can continue that movement, and we do agree that we'd want him to continue fighting for that and continue trying to change that, but it just wouldn't be the same because he wouldn't have that same power. He wouldn't have as much of an opportunity closer to make that happen. It would be a lot harder and probably take a longer time to accomplish and make occur. But if he's in the presidency, then we'll definitely be one step closer to making that happen. But if he's not, it's just I feel like it's just going to be a lot of fighting that's not going to amount to anything because no one's going to want that. If the Republicans are there, they're not going to want that to happen. They're gonna make sure that's not going to happen. So if we can still fight. We would love to still fight. We'd want to still fight. But it would be really disappointing that it just would be fighting for nothing. And that's the part that's disappointing.
So there aren't any circumstances under which you'd vote for Hillary? I mean, what if Donald Trump is leading the Republicans, or even Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio for that matter? They're, you know, to a lot of people that I talk to, they're scared to death of those people. So
I am very scared. It terrifies me, the idea of Donald Trump possibly being my president. Like, I already decided as soon as that happens, I'm leaving the country. I don't want to be here. I don't want to be a part of that. That's not something I want to live through.
But wouldn't you vote for Hillary to avoid that?
If it came down to that, that's probably what's going to happen. But it wouldn't really be me voting for what I want. It'd be me voting for whatever, it would just be a really depressing vote. It would be really disappointing. It wouldn't really be me voting. It would me be just going with the better bad decision.
So going back to Obama, and of course that was 8 years ago or 7 years ago when he got elected, there was a sense that a lot of minorities, particularly African Americans in this country, felt a lot of empowerment, particularly young African American kids could see for the first time that there was somebody that looked like them that was actually in the highest office in the land. So why would that not translate to Hillary Clinton becoming the first female president? Wouldn't the very act of finally having a woman as president of the United States encourage and validate young women?
It will, but it just won't be the same because we're looking at her as a person. We're again masking the whole idea of just gender. We're just following that gender, but we have to look at each individual as a person, regardless of their gender. Okay, Hillary Clinton's a female. Hillary Clinton, if she's the first female president, it'll be a big deal. It'll probably make a lot of women feel a lot more powerful and make them want to strive more and do the same effect it had with Obama. But at the same time, it wouldn't, because then they'd look back at who she is as a person and they wouldn't be happy with that. It would just make females, I feel, disappointed that that's the female we got. That's the first female president we got. We couldn't do any better.
So what is it about Bernie, this 74-year-old senator from Vermont, that's got you so excited? I mean, obviously, as a young feminist, you think that your natural bias would be towards the woman candidate, but no, it's not. And I take it a lot of your friends and peers feel that same way. So explain to us, if you will, why Bernie is so attractive to you.
It's just the approach he has to everything. He first of all, he knows what he's talking about because he's been in the whole political business for a long time. Well, not business, but you know what I mean. Like, he's been part of that for a long time, so he knows what he's doing. He offers what we want. He's an approachable guy. I know he's from Brooklyn. He's from the same neighborhood I'm growing up in my whole life. We get to know him as a person. That's the one thing that's very different now about the younger generation and the older generation. We look at people as people. We really focus on who they are as a person and how they're going to handle situations as a person. And when we look at Hillary, we see something fake. We see something very masked. We see something very not genuine, but something about Bernie is very genuine. Something about Bernie makes us feel comfortable, makes us feel safe, makes us feel like we have a chance at bettering this country, at becoming something more than what we are, because America has been coming more and more disappointing as the years have gone by. It's just been kind of going down and down and down, and we're supposed to have this whole attitude of America the great, America is the best, blah, 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 but we're losing that. And when we see Bernie and what he has to say and what he has to offer, it makes us feel like we have hope. It makes us feel like this country has a chance at actually becoming something great, something better, something happy.
But in terms of experience, I don't think anybody could make the case that Hillary Clinton's not experienced. I mean, she's
full. Well, Hillary Clinton's not obviously very experienced, but I don't feel like she cares as much about the people as we think. Like, I feel like she tries to get that out there, but not entirely. Like, I feel like she just, at the end of the day, everything's going to be the same. It's not, nothing's really going to change.
Well, there's certainly a lot of enthusiasm on Bernie's side and an enthusiasm deficit on Hillary Clinton's side. And one of the things that I find a little ironic is that people that actually know Hillary Clinton said that she's not stiff and she's much more fun and approachable.
Really?
Yeah.
This, I never felt that.
Well, no, I'm saying that I'm just going to make the comparison with Al Gore, who lost to George W. Bush. He apparently, in person, was a very funny, self-deprecating guy, and yet on the campaign trail, he was a total stiff, and George W. Bush, you know, managed to win, even though he didn't win the presidency. So is it possible that this is just a question of whether she's a bad campaigner? I mean, she certainly lost the campaign against Barack Obama in 2008, and frankly, many critics of her campaign are looking at what she's doing now and thinking, my God, she's doing exactly what she did back in 2008. So there seems to be something wrong with the way she campaigns. I'm not trying to make excuses for her, but I'm suggesting...
No, I get it.
Yeah, okay. Well, go ahead and tell me what you think.
She's just basically doing the same thing people do with history. They don't learn from their mistakes. They don't. Maybe she thinks, oh, if she just does the same, maybe she thinks when she was campaigning before with Barack Obama, it was just simply because since he was an African-American, that's why she lost. So she thinks maybe if she does the same thing, it'll work out because it's the same system. She's not looking to change her system. So maybe if she changed her campaigning, things would be different for her. But if she's just doing the same thing she did in 2008, she's just digging the hole deeper for herself to not amount to anything.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Amanita Fanaro, tell me about, you say that social media is obviously your milieu and your generation's milieu. I take it then that the buzz all around is about Bernie and not about Hillary.
No, yeah, it's pretty much everyone on social media just talks about Donald Trump and Bernie. That's the two most they talk about. There'll be some Hillary Clinton stuff, but people don't even really bother with her, I feel like, on social media as much because no one really likes her as much. So I feel like within my generation, no one even really bothers talking about her because they just don't really have anything to say. But when it comes to Bernie and Donald Trump, it's nonstop. It's everywhere. It's all over the news feed. It's all over social media. Everyone's nonstop talking about it and throwing out their opinions and throwing out what they have to say. And since that's what we're seeing more, that's who we're getting to know more. That's who we're discovering more. That's who we're finding out more, and that's who we end up liking more. Maybe if Hillary Clinton put herself out there more on social media, maybe she'd become more approachable. I know, I still, it wouldn't be the same. But social media definitely is a way for us teens and late 20s to early 20s to see that political side. And that whole other side is a completely different side. And we're talking about everything. We're putting down their opinions. It's all over the place.
Right. But just in closing, there's a world of difference between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, surely.
Oh, yeah, there's a huge difference. Donald Trump is a businessman. He's not a political man. He's going to end up paying people to do everything for him, and that's just disappointing. I feel like it's just a bunch of yelling with him. I feel like there isn't really any opinion. I don't know where he's going with anything he says. It always ends up being very confusing, and I feel always so disappointed. Like, what is he doing? I feel like he's almost making a joke out of himself, or if he's just trying to become more famous. I don't know what Trump wants.
But Bernie, on the other hand, is somebody that you are prepared to give your first vote when you turn 18 in June.
Yes, I would not be disappointed by that at all.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for calling.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And again, I've been speaking with Amanita Fanaro, who's a student in New York City and a first-time voter in the 2016 presidential race. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with another opinion of which of the two Democratic presidential candidates is winning the feminist vote. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Gloria Felt, who's the co-founder and president of Take the Lead and the author of No Excuses, 9 Ways Women Can Change How We Think About Power. She's an expert on leadership and women's relationships with power, a media commentator, and a keynote speaker. A former teen mom, she became a successful CEO and was president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gloria Felt.
Thank you so much, Ian. Happy to be here.
And Gloria, what do you make of this division going on between younger and older and feminists that has been brought to the fore by remarks from former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright in support of Hillary Clinton, saying that there's a special place in hell for women who don't help other women? And then on last Friday on the Bill Maher HBO show, Gloria Steinem said that, talking about younger women, saying they're going to get more activists as they get older. And when you're young, you're thinking, where are the boys? The boys are with Bernie. And that, of course, has not sat well with a lot of Bernie's supporters. So this doesn't seem like a particularly useful intramural battle.
Well, I would agree with you 100% that it doesn't seem like a particularly useful battle, because with all due respect, none of it has the slightest thing to do with who is the better candidate. And in the bigger sense, it's a ridiculous waste of precious political capital and political discussion. There are a few things that I know from the work that I've done in advocating for women over the years, and that is that, first of all, you know, every generation has to speak in its own tongue. And the Madeleine Albright quote is one that has been repeated over and over and over again with much success, and that there always comes a moment when something changes, and you don't always know what that moment is going to be. And I think in context that we need to recognize that what I call sister courage, in other words, women helping other women, is probably the only successful strategy that is ever going to get women to full equality and parity in any sphere. So in basic principle, it's absolutely true that it's important for women to help other women, just as it's important for any group to help itself. And if I may say that an issue that is often overlooked in this debate, as it was in the Obama-Clinton race, is that every other group votes its interests and no one ever utters a peep. You know, the majority of white men vote overwhelmingly Republican, for example. 90%+ of African Americans voted for Obama, and nobody uttered a peep. But when women say they're going to support other women because they really would like to see a woman president, it's judged negatively.
So what explains then that in Iowa, in the caucuses, women aged 18 to 29 voted for Bernie Sanders over Hillary Clinton by a margin of roughly 6-1?
Well, as my grandson, who is a Bernie supporter, explains to me, it has a lot to do with how young people, millennial voters in general, look at the world. And I understand that. I mean, I understand that. Women who have been through the battles of fighting to open doors and change laws so that those young women have equal access to all of the good things in life, we understand what it took to get here, and we understand what an amazing step forward it would be for women if there were a woman president. But, you know, when you haven't had that opportunity to know life without having the opportunity to advance yourself as a woman, I mean, I don't, younger women simply haven't had that same experience. And I don't think that there's any kind of negativity attached to that. It just simply is one of the facts of life. But you don't persuade people of any age by scolding them in any sort of way or by stereotyping them in any sort of way. You have to respect where people are. And that's why I say you have to speak in tongues people understand. And for younger women who haven't had the experience of being shut out, of not getting the promotion, of not getting the job, of not getting the opportunity to achieve their goals in life or even to have goals in life, they're not going to understand the situation in the same way that those of us who have been through those battles understand it. So we have to find other ways to talk with them.
And again, I'm speaking with Gloria Felt, who's the co-founder and president of Take the Lead and the author of No Excuses, 9 Ways Women Can Change How We Think About Power. A former teen mom, she became a successful CEO and was president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. So I guess in many ways, it's just simply not a good idea to tell people how to vote. Susan Sarandon, of course, made the infamous statement that I don't vote with my vagina. But what do you think that Hillary can do? I know that Gloria Steinem's walked back her comments. Hillary, of course, didn't make either of these two comments, but they're pretty much being lumped on her, if you will.
Exactly.
How is she going to get around this?
I think that's a very, very excellent question. You know, we're in the midst of a half-finished revolution, and it makes all these questions more complicated than they were when Madeleine Albright was starting out, for example. And I do believe that in the final analysis, for all women of any age, the agenda of a candidate is more important than their gender. I mean, you have to look at the whole candidate. You have to look at the whole person. And I think the only way Hillary moves beyond this is to give voters of all ages and both men and women a bigger vision of what she's about, who she is, and what she will do for the country. I mean, ultimately, you cannot win a debate like this by being defensive about it. You can't win a debate like this by answering it. You can only move people forward to a bigger vision, a better vision of who you are and where you will move the country. And that's what people ultimately need to be casting their votes on.
So do you think that there is this divide then between the older feminists who felt they did the heavy lifting and the younger feminists who are accused of not appreciating the work that's been done so far, not to suggest that there's still not a long way to go, given the still pay inequity, et cetera? By no means is the feminist revolution complete.
Definitely, the revolution is unfinished, and that's absolutely true. I mean, these young women don't yet realize it, but as things stand right now, they're probably going to earn $500,000 to $1 million less than the young man standing next to them of the same age and with the same education and the same opportunities. So you don't realize that until you're much older. I think in answer to your question, I will just tell you my personal experience, which is that I think that, and I believe Gloria Steinem may have said the same thing, I really see younger women today being more activist and more likely to be interested in the feminist movement per se or in the remaining inequities to be rectified than I've seen in a long time. And I'm often blessed by having young women just simply write to me over the transom. I mean, they're interested. They want to get involved. They want to know what they can do. I will tell you that Take the Lead is a very new organization. We're just about 3 years old now. And much of the work we have been able to do has happened because young women have dropped me a note, they've found me on social media, they've written emails to me and said, I want to get involved, how can I help? And we wouldn't have been able to do what we've done so quickly with building up training programs and other things for women that they feel they need if it hadn't been for young women who were deeply, deeply interested in advancing women in general.
So prior to your appearing on today's program, Gloria Felt, I spoke with a young feminist in New York who is 17, about to turn 18, and her first vote is going to be cast for Bernie Sanders. And she spoke incredibly passionately about Bernie Sanders. And I asked her what would happen if Bernie doesn't make it to the presidential nomination and Hillary does. Would she and her generation still vote, given that the alternatives on the Republican side are Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, and Marco Rubio? And she said basically that her and her peers would be so disappointed they probably wouldn't vote for Hillary. So if that's true, Hillary's got a major problem.
Well, now that's a very darn fool thing to say. And if there is something I would want to say to young women, it is this. The political process is never a perfect one. It is simply never a perfect one. But if we are not involved, if we do not cast our votes, if we do not do what we can do to get the outcomes that we want, we can't complain. And there's no question but what any time we have the opportunity to cast a vote, we need to cast a vote, because it's that's the essence of democracy, and we can't give up on it.
So what do you think, though, Hillary can do, though, in terms of a political strategy? Because obviously Madeleine Albright and Gloria Steinem's support for her, I think, have certainly backfired amongst the young voters. And clearly, if Bernie Sanders has brought them into the tent, and if he doesn't make it, then she does, you got to figure a way to keep them into the tent. And, you know, maybe Bernie Sanders can continue a political movement, since he's somewhat like a Pied Piper who's got a whole bunch of young people motivated. And I guess that gets back to the question of not of what, whether Hillary would in fact have him as a vice president.
I think that's an interesting question. I wondered that myself, and of course I have no insights whatsoever as to whether that could ever happen or would ever happen. I don't know. But what I do think is that, and at the risk of repeating something that I said earlier, I think that for any candidate, and this is the winning strategy for Hillary, for any candidate, what you have to do is you have to give people a bigger vision of who you are, what you stand for, and what you will do for the country. And if she can do that, she can pull this out. I mean, let's face it, a good deal of what's happening right now is the media just needed to whip up the whole thing into a gotcha of epidemic proportions. It's not a relevant argument about anything of substance that's going on in this campaign, and Hillary Clinton needs to lead the way for people to get back to the important issues of the campaign and talk about what her plans are, what she will do for the country, and who she is as a person. And I would give that same advice to any political candidate at any time of any party in any race. You got to give people a bigger vision. That's what they want to follow.
But is there a sort of, just in closing, a kind of comparison here between Al Gore and Hillary Clinton, as much as Al Gore personally, I'm told, was a charming, self-deprecating, funny guy, but on the stump he was a stiff. And I'm also told that Hillary Clinton in person is very, very funny, and she's great fun to be around. And that's not what she projects on the stump, and that's, I think, what turns off a lot of young voters. They think she's calculating and cold.
Well, I do agree that she could be a little looser, but I also think that people have to be just who they are. And you can't make someone into something they are not. I mean, you know, Bernie Sanders isn't exactly a loosey-goosey guy either. You know, he's very serious. He has a sense of humor, as she does. But, you know, I think I'd actually put the two of them as being somewhat equal on that level. But I think that it's important for people to be able to relate to other human beings out there, and that actually Hillary Clinton does a pretty good job of that. And I think that you'll see as the campaign goes on, she'll probably get even better at it. I saw her when she first was running for Senate in New York. And it was hard for her to loosen up and really interact with people on the stump, even though, as you say, she was very personable and had a great sense of humor in a small group and with individuals. But I saw her learn. She's a learner, and she's a listener, and she pays attention. And I suspect she'll get better and better at it as the campaign goes on.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Gloria Felt.
Thank you so much, Ian. Great to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Gloria Felt, who's a co-founder and president of Take the Lead and the author of No Excuses, 9 Ways Women Can Change How We Think About Power. A former teen mum, she became a successful CEO and was president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with the author of an article at Foreign Policy, Obama's Disastrous Betrayal of the Syrian Rebels. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Emil Hokayam, who's a senior fellow at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Obama's Disastrous Betrayal of the Syrian Rebels, How the White House is Handing Victory to Bashar al-Assad, Russia, and Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Emil Hokayam.
Thank you for having me.
And when you say that the White House is handing victory to Bashar al-Assad, Russia, and Iran, that certainly appears to be the case all along from the outset of this civil war. The Iranians have known what they want, and the Russians, now that they're on the scene, know what they want. But the U.S. knows what they don't want, but they never seem to have known what they do want. And what would the explanation be, though, for handing a victory to Russia and Iran? Is this incompetence or is this cynicism?
I think it's a mix of both, but it's also a very understandable sense in the U.S. that Middle Eastern conflicts never work to the benefit of the U.S. and that the U.S. ends up being stuck in protracted wars that it has to manage. This is totally understandable after the experience of Iraq and Afghanistan. But I think in this particular case, America, in a way, overlearned its lesson from Iraq in particular. And I certainly don't think that the current situation whereby Russia and Iran have the upper hand is what Washington prefers or desires. But it's a logical outcome of, I would say, in absence of policy and a reluctance to face the magnitude of this conflict. For some time, Syria was considered a war that could be contained. This is something we heard a lot from Washington in the first few years of the uprising. And now with the massive repercussions on the neighborhood, with the massive refugee crisis, the Syrian war is anything but contained.
But it seems to me that Vladimir Putin, of course, it's an unusual situation to have a combination of nuclear weapons and organized crime in geopolitics. And nuclear weapons is a scary mix. And he's obviously a very tough guy, to put it mildly. And he seems to be somewhat focused more on what he can do to make life difficult for the Americans as opposed to what he can do for the people of Russia. And he seems to be, I think, do you think that a part of his strategy is not just to secure these bases that he has in Syria, but also, since he's prosecuting the air war like he did in Chechnya with indiscriminate casualties? And the other day, Secretary Kerry, I've never heard him so angry denouncing these airstrikes and how they not only blow up civilians, but then when the ambulances and the rescue workers come in, they come back for a second bombing run. It seems to me that part of the strategy of stitching up the West is that he's creating this flood of refugees into Europe. And that's dividing Europe, which is weakening the EU.
I'm no Russia specialist. I focus on the Middle East. So let me look at it from how all this is seen from here. Vladimir Putin is certainly seeking to reshape the Middle Eastern regional order. And the United States used to be the prime architect of that order until recently. And it's clear that President Obama has no interest in either sustaining the old order or contributing to building a new one along American wishes. So Vladimir Putin saw a window here to come and impose his rules of the game. In addition, one Arab official once told me a year ago, I don't like what Putin does, but I like how he does it. At a time where President Obama is seen as a very intellectual, professorial president who agonizes over decision-making and foreign policy and is very cautious, etc., Vladimir Putin comes across as determined, ruthless, businesslike, you know, with a clarity of purpose, with a willingness to deploy force that makes him look like, you know, the real shaper of events here. Now, a lot of people would argue, and, you know, with good reason, that caution in foreign policy is the wisest thing to go. Headline writers love boldness in foreign policy, but over time, there is a cost to it. But the point here is that, America's traditional allies in the region see the dithering of the U.S. administration and compare this to the steadfastness of Russia. And even though they prefer the U.S. overall, they still align or they still try to accommodate or appease Russia currently, precisely because of that division. Moreover, I think that, Vladimir Putin is sees no nuance in the Middle East. I mean, his Middle East is very black and white. While I think President Obama does have an appreciation for the complexity here, but perhaps the President Obama's appreciation for the complexity goes a bit too far in that sense. In President Obama has one achievement, a very significant achievement, and that's the Iran nuclear deal. But it seems like everything else in terms of U.S. policy in the region has become hostage to this deal and today to protecting this one achievement. Certainly America's policy looks quite wobbly these days.
So what do you think Tony Blinken, the senior advisor to President Obama, what did he mean when he more or less said to Putin when he first stepped into Syria, "Welcome to the quagmire"? I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah, I mean, Deputy Secretary Blinken, like President Obama, basically described Russia's entry into Syria as a quagmire, the beginning of a quagmire. And I think their assessments were off, and that's plainly clear now. Not that Russia is not going to face and is not facing costs, now it is, but Russia is able to justify the cost. And in the absence of an American strategy and a willingness to match the escalation, the cost is entirely bearable at this point. And if anything, while President Obama, Secretary Kerry, and everyone else in the U.S. administration love to say that there is no military solution to the Syrian conflict, certainly Vladimir Putin, Bashar al-Assad, their Iranian allies, and their Shia jihadis who are fighting in Syria, do see a way towards a military victory, and they're pushing ahead. So I think there is a lot of, wishful, I would even say deluded thinking in Washington about how things go. But it wouldn't be the first time in this administration that we see that. I want to remind the listeners that in January 2014, President Obama, in an interview to The New Yorker, described ISIS, a growing jihadi group at that time, he described ISIS as the JV team of terrorism. While we, Middle Eastern specialists and specialists on extremism and jihadism, etc., we're basically warning about the growing monster. And President Obama dismissed that. And I think that's partly the product of a mindset where President Obama is very reluctant to come back to the Middle East. He announced the end of the era of wars in the region and was wishful in this regard. But that's not the only assessment that the U.S. administration got wrong with regard to the Middle East. President Obama promised that he would not send troops to Iraq again after the exit in 2011, which, was, a campaign promise. And certainly he deserves credit for sticking by it, except that a couple years later, precisely because of his misreading of dynamics in the region, he was forced to send back troops, and today I think there are around 3,500 Americans deployed in Iraq, and the U.S. Air Force bombs Syria and Iraq on a daily basis. But again, with a very narrow, wrong strategy, where it's primarily a counterterrorism strategy, while ISIS, which is certainly a very dangerous gathering threat to the region, but also beyond, is in fact the symptom of the problem, is the product of the civil wars in Syria and Iraq. Just dealing with the symptom is not going to take us very far.
Well, of course, the counterterrorism versus counterinsurgency strategy was argued over in Afghanistan between Joe Biden, Vice President Biden, and General Petraeus. But you're suggesting here that we need more than a counterterrorism strategy in Iraq and Syria against Daesh. So what then is Turkey and Saudi? The Saudi Arabians are threatening. The Saudi Arabians are threatening to bring in some troops via Turkey. And I'm not sure whether that's serious enough. And of course, on the Turkish side, you have to recognize, I think, that Erdogan's foreign policy is in tatters. And he's a somewhat headstrong person. So is there any, and that would be difficult, wouldn't it, if he got involved militarily in Syria? You'd have a NATO ally butting heads with Russia. So walk us through those options, if you will, Emil Agayem.
Let me first clarify something. I don't think it is desirable or smart for the U.S. to send back ground troops in the Middle East after, the very traumatic experience of Iraq and Afghanistan. So I don't understand the reluctance in Washington, and I do understand the reluctance of the average American to be back there. But one lesson that we've learned from Iraq and Afghanistan is that if you want to deal real setbacks to these insurgencies and these extremist movements like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, you need the support of local communities. In Syria, that means recognizing that local communities see Bashar al-Assad, whose family has ruled over Syria since 1970, as the greater threat, not ISIS. I understand why America, European countries, others consider ISIS as the greater threat. But as far as Syrians are concerned, Bashar al-Assad is a much greater threat. He has committed atrocities in much greater number than ISIS, and all the atrocities that ISIS has committed, from burning people alive to executions to beheadings, etc. So we should understand that from the perspective of the local communities, those best disposed and equipped to fight those radicals, Assad remains a greater threat. This is why it is essential for the U.S. and others to not see Assad as the lesser evil compared to ISIS. Assad is not the lesser evil, and there should be a strategy aimed at pushing him out, not necessarily through military means, but not purely through, political talks like we saw in Geneva that are backed with zero leverage and very wishy-washy American policy. And that's essential. Once this is done, or once this is the process of ousting Assad is in motion, then it becomes easier to mobilize those Sunni Muslim communities across Syria that don't like ISIS but see ISIS as less threatening than Assad. That's when you mobilize all these communities to push back ISIS. And the good news is that they've already done so in the past, except that we haven't taken them seriously. We haven't provided them with the appropriate military and other support. We tend to brush all Syrian rebels with one color as if they're all radicals and extremists. And this is not the case. There is a wide spectrum, and there is a lot of people in Syria that Western countries, Arab countries, etc., can work with. And they're not all ISIS, and they're not all Jabhat al-Nusra, Al-Qaeda. So that's an essential point to make. Now, with regard to the regional response, I think regional countries have a massive responsibility here. We talk a lot about the role of the U.S., and at times Americans get tired, as if Middle Easterners have no agency and responsibility here. And that's, I think that's a very fair criticism. So the region needs to step up as well. But for the region to step up, again, we have to get the politics right. Turkey, as you say, has been a pretty problematic state in recent years. It prioritizes the containment of Kurdish autonomous aspirations in Syria and Turkey elsewhere over the fight against ISIS. Saudi Arabia is more concerned, and very understandably so, about Iran expansionism in the region, given the very fraught history between the two, etc. I think only the United States is positioned to orchestrate a real coalition here. The Saudis and the Turks are not telling the Americans we're going to go at it alone. They basically say we want American guidance. We want American leadership. And I don't think President Obama is interested in this now. And I think it would be very disruptive if these countries were to intervene alone out of frustration or out of spite because of a lack of American engagement.
Well, but on the other side, you've got facts on the ground being created by Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah. There's not much of an, as far as I know, much of an Assad's army is left. So all these gains, as they encircle Aleppo, the second largest city in Syria, which is about to fall, and then you'll have this Assad, starving the remaining population out, which is he's done to other towns. And they, again, you get back to this asymmetry that the Iranians and the Russians know what they want, and we don't know what we want. So as long as we don't know what we want, they're going to win.
Well, this is essentially the story of the past 5 years, where, the U.S. administration has ran away from the hard choices. There were plenty of options that were available to Washington to deal with the Syrian crisis for some time. And each of them has been rejected or ridiculed. President Obama called that, his critics, accuses his critics of offering mumbo-jumbo options, although a lot of his advisors, including cabinet secretaries like Hillary Clinton and Leon Panetta and David Petraeus and many others, have recommended options that President Obama himself has rejected. And it's actually worth remembering that in 2013, President Obama announced strikes against Bashar al-Assad, which I think would have weakened the regime enough that it would have had to generally enter negotiations. And then President Obama canceled them at the last minute. So it's a record of failed policy making. Understandably, the environment, the context are extremely difficult, but in the U.S., I'm not American, but what's the dictum? The buck stops here. So President Obama has to take responsibility for the failure of his own approach towards the problem. I'm not saying that there is a silver bullet today, and I do accept that there is a very complex situation, and the risks are high. The U.S. today is not interested in direct military intervention in Syria, in part because that would lead to perhaps a direct escalation against Russia, and who wants those two major powers to face off? That certainly is not desirable. But America cannot at the same time expect Syrian rebel leaders and opposition leaders to go to Geneva without any kind of Western Arab real support and leverage. And this is what's happening. America is actually cutting off or asking its allies to cut off weapon supplies to the mainstream rebels. These are not hardcore, these are not radical Islamist rebels. These are mainstream fighters. One can disagree with their outlook, etc., but they're certainly not anywhere close to ISIS or Al-Qaeda. And it does so to get Russian consent and approval for the negotiation. So as Russia and Iran escalate their role in Syria, America de-escalates. That is setting up America's partners for failure. I'm not the one who wrote the headline in the foreign policy piece. As you know, editors do so. And the word betrayal is not mine. It comes from rebel commanders who complain about their treatment. And it's worth keeping in mind that these are the rebels that, you know, have the legitimacy, the intelligence, the human power, the understanding of the terrain to fight ISIS. These are not only fighting Assad, they're also fighting ISIS. They're fighting a war that America cares about and has a great interest in winning. So Washington has a lot to do in terms of you know, rethinking its approach, but I don't think that we're there yet, and I don't think Washington knows what the end goal is and is not willing to dedicate the proper resources. So we're a long way. The Syrian conflict is shaping the Middle East in quite profound ways, and not just the Middle East. The consequences are felt in Europe and beyond.
Well, Emil Akayem, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Emil Akayem, who's a senior fellow at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. He has an article at Foreign Policy, Obama's Disastrous Betrayal of the Syrian Rebels, How the White House is Handing Victory to Bashar al-Assad, Russia, and Iran. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.